A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's been digging through political history and wants the greatest hits of hubris. He's after the parties that launch like they were about to redraw the map, with famous faces, serious money, and absolute certainty that the public was waiting for them, only to faceplant so completely that the results read like a rounding error. He wants to know what they thought the public wanted, how badly they misread the room, and whether they were destroyed by absurd policies, terrible branding, ideological confusion, personal vanity, or just the awkward fact that nobody showed up. And he's especially interested in the gap between the ambition and the result, the lost deposits, the microscopic vote totals, the rapid disintegration.
So we went digging through the graveyard of political ambition, and the tombstones are hilarious.
They really are. And what's striking is how many of these parties weren't jokes at the start. Some of them were jokes by the end, but they launched with genuine belief that they'd found a gap in the market.
Right. And that's what makes a political failure spectacular rather than just sad. A party that quietly runs and loses isn't interesting. A party that rents out a conference center, puts up banners, brings in the television cameras, and then gets fewer votes than the building's seating capacity. That's the category we're talking about.
The gap between the press release and the ballot count.
And the pattern repeats across decades and countries. You get a founder, often wealthy, often famous, who convinces themselves that their personal diagnosis of what's wrong with politics is shared by millions of people who are just waiting for someone to say it. They hire staff, they print leaflets, they book venues, and then election night arrives and the returning officer reads out a number so small that everyone in the room pretends they didn't hear it.
And the thing is, some of these parties had real money behind them. James Goldsmith and the Referendum Party, he poured something like 20 million pounds of his own fortune into it. That's not pocket change, even for a billionaire. He hired hundreds of candidates, ran a slick national campaign, and in the 1997 election, he got 2.6% of the vote and zero seats. Zero.
2.6%. Goldsmith died shortly after the election, and the party dissolved. But here's the part that makes it more than just a rich man's vanity project. He had a single issue. Britain should have a referendum on membership in the European Union. That was it. And the party's pressure, combined with the broader Euroskeptic movement, eventually helped force the Conservatives to promise that referendum, which led to Brexit.
So the failure wasn't zero impact. It was just zero impact in the way he intended.
Right. He wanted to be the vehicle, and instead he was the warning shot. The Tories absorbed the demand and left him with nothing. That's a recurring theme. Established parties are very good at co-opting the energy of insurgents without giving them any credit or seats.
But let's talk about the SDP, because that's the one that really haunts British politics. 1981, four senior Labour moderates, Roy Jenkins, David Owen, Bill Rogers, Shirley Williams, they walk out of Labour with enormous media fanfare. The King of Four. They announce a new party, the Social Democratic Party, and the early polls are staggering. 40%.
40% in some polls. It was genuinely unprecedented. The British public had never seen a breakaway like this, and for a moment, it looked like they might actually win. But here's what people forget about those polls. The pollsters were asking things like, would you support a new centre party? They weren't naming the SDP. They weren't asking about specific candidates or policies. It was a hypothetical. And when the hypothetical became a real party with real internal tensions and real candidates who sometimes said awkward things, the numbers softened.
The mirage factor.
And then the Falklands War happened in 1982. Thatcher's approval surged. The SDP's moment, which depended on a disaffected center, was suddenly gone. They won a handful of by-elections, but in the 1983 general election, they got 25% of the vote and only 23 seats. The Liberals, their alliance partners, got 25% and 17 seats. That's more than 50% of the vote between them and 40 seats total. First past the post just ate them alive.
25% of the vote for 23 seats. Labor got 28% and 209 seats. The system wasn't designed for third parties.
It absolutely was not. And then the internal feud started. Jenkins wanted to merge with the Liberals. Owen didn't. They fought about it for years, and in 1988, the party merged with the Liberals to become the Liberal Democrats. Owen refused to join and formed a rump, SDP, that limped along for a couple more years before dying. The whole thing was 4 years of genuine excitement followed by 6 years of slow, bitter disintegration.
And yet the legacy is real. The SDP's existence, the threat they represented, pushed Labour toward the center. Without the SDP, there's probably no Tony Blair, or at least not in the form he took. The parent party absorbed the lesson.
Which brings us to Change UK in 2019, the modern echo. 11 MPs, 7 from Labour, 4 from the Conservatives, they walk out and form the Independent Group. Massive media coverage. Front pages. The claim was they were going to change politics for good, and then the trouble started immediately.
They couldn't even agree on a name.
They couldn't agree on anything. The Independent Group became Change UK, then briefly became the Independent Group for Change. At one point, they applied to register as a party and discovered someone else already had the name they wanted. This is basic stuff. You're launching a national political movement and you haven't checked whether your name is available?
It's like opening a restaurant and forgetting to check if the building has a kitchen.
And the policy platform was, what exactly? They were against Brexit. They were for something called evidence-based policy. They thought politics should be nicer. It was a party built on vibes. And the vibes were, we're reasonable people, and the existing parties are not. Which is a fine sentiment for a dinner party, but it's not a political platform.
The European elections in 2019 were the test. They got 3.4%, no seats. The Brexit party, which had launched around the same time, got 31% and 29 seats. The contrast was brutal.
Within months, most of their MPs had either lost their seats in the general election, returned to their old parties, or left politics entirely. The whole thing lasted less than a year. And here's the thing that connects Change UK to the SDP. Both groups assumed the public was as obsessed with their internal ideological battles as they were. The SDP thought the country was crying out for a centrist alternative to Thatcher and Foot. Change UK thought Brexit fatigue meant there was a huge market for a new center party. But voters don't reward parties that exist to solve a problem they don't feel, especially when the party itself is a mess of egos.
The empty rally phenomenon. The SDP had these early poll numbers that turned out to be phantom support. Change UK had launch events that the media covered like a royal wedding, but their actual campaign events were sparsely attended, and their internal polling showed they were nowhere near the 20% they were claiming publicly.
There's a phrase for this. The difference between a protest answer in a poll and actually walking to a polling station on a rainy Thursday. The gap is enormous, and these parties consistently mistake the first for the second.
So let's move to the truly absurd end of the spectrum, the Natural Law Party.
Oh, this is the good stuff.
This is a party that ran candidates in the UK and the US, and its core policy proposal was yogic flying.
Yogic flying. Which is, for listeners who haven't had the pleasure, a practice associated with the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi's transcendental meditation movement. Practitioners sit in the lotus position and bounce. They sort of hop. And the claim was that if enough people practiced yogic flying together, it'd create a field of coherence that would reduce crime, lower taxes, and solve social problems.
This wasn't a metaphor. This was their actual policy platform. They put it in their manifestos. They ran hundreds of candidates in the 1992 UK general election and got 0.19% of the vote. In 1997, they got 0.33%.
That's the kind of number where you start wondering if the candidates themselves voted.
In the US, they ran John Hagelin for president 3 times. He was a physicist, which made the whole thing even stranger. You'd see him in debates, a perfectly articulate man with a PhD from Harvard, explaining that the solution to urban crime was group meditation. His best result was in 1996, when he got 0.12% of the vote.
And here's the thing about the Natural Law Party that separates it from the SDP or Change UK. Those parties were sincere, but incompetent. The Natural Law Party was, I don't even know, was it sincere? The people involved seemed to believe it. But the gap between the belief and any plausible theory of how politics works was so vast that it almost circles back around to performance art.
Which brings us to the Monster Raving Loony Party, which actually is performance art. They've been running in UK elections since 1983. Their founder was a musician called Screaming Lord Sutch, and their policies include things like breeding fish in the Houses of Parliament because the atmosphere is so wet. They get about 0.1% of the vote.
But here's the twist. The Loony Party is still around. They've outlasted the SDP, Change UK, Veritas, the Referendum Party, and the Natural Law Party. They're a beloved institution. And they're the exception that proves the rule, because they never claim to be anything other than a joke. The real humiliation is when a sincere party gets fewer votes than the joke party.
And that happened. In the 1997 UK election, the Natural Law Party got 0.33%. The Monster Raving Loony Party got 0.1%. But in some constituencies, the Loony candidate beat the Natural Law candidate. Imagine being the person who ran on yogurt flying and lost to a man dressed as a pirate.
Let's talk about the Vanity Party subcategory. These are parties built around a single person's ego, where the founder seems to believe that their personal celebrity is a substitute for a political base.
Robert Kilroy Silk and Veritas.
2005. Kilroy Silk was a former Labour MP who'd become a television presenter, a kind of daytime talk show host. He joined UKIP, became an MEP, and then fell out with the UKIP leadership in spectacular fashion. So he quit and founded his own party, Veritas, which is Latin for truth. He announced it would be a major force in British politics. He was going to transform the right.
He got 0.5% in the 2005 general election, half of 1%, and the party collapsed within a year. He resigned as leader. The party limped along for a bit, and then it died.
The thing about Kilroy Silk is that he was famous, but he was famous in a way that didn't translate to votes. Being recognized from television isn't the same as being trusted with a ballot, and he seemed shocked that the public didn't flock to him. The gap between his self-perception and his actual political appeal was...
Arthur Scargill and the Socialist Labour Party, same baton. Scargill was the leader of the National Union of Mine Workers during the 1984 strike. He was a genuine historical figure. He founded the Socialist Labour Party in 1996 and predicted a new dawn for socialism. He got 0.8% in 1997 and never won a seat. The party still technically exists, but it's a ghost.
0.8%. That's the former leader of one of the most powerful unions in British history, a man who'd been on the front pages for years, and he couldn't even crack 1%. The public had moved on, and he hadn't noticed.
The U.S. has its own versions. The Bull Moose Party in 1912 is the interesting edge case because it actually did something. Teddy Roosevelt split from the Republicans, ran as a progressive, and got 27% of the vote and 88 electoral votes. He finished second, ahead of the sitting Republican president, William Howard Taft.
But he didn't win, and the party dissolved after the election. Roosevelt's ambition was to be president again, and instead he handed the White House to Woodrow Wilson by splitting the Republican vote. It's the classic third-party trap. You're strong enough to be a spoiler, but not strong enough to win.
The Dixiecrats in 1948 are similar. Strom Thurmond and a group of Southern Democrats broke away over civil rights. They won 4 Southern states and 39 electoral votes. They dissolved shortly after, but their real impact was accelerating the Southern realignment that eventually turned the South Republican.
And then there's Ross Perot and the Reform Party. Perot got 19% in 1992 as an independent, which is astonishing. He was on the ballot in all 50 states, he spent millions of his own money, and he tapped into a real vein of economic anxiety and anti-establishment anger. But by 2000, the party was a zombie. Pat Buchanan took it over, his nomination caused a split, and the whole thing collapsed into irrelevance.
19% to nothing in 8 years. That's the shelf life of a personality-driven movement. When the personality leaves or loses, the movement evaporates.
And that's the core question underneath all of this. What were these parties actually? Were they movements or were they moods? A movement has infrastructure, local branches, a theory of change, a base of people who will show up even when the polls are bad. A mood is just a feeling that floats around for a while and then dissipates. Almost all of these parties were moods.
The SDP came closest to being a real movement. They had tens of thousands of members. They won by elections. They had genuine local organizations. But even they couldn't survive the combination of a hostile electoral system and internal feuds.
The internal feud is the universal killer. Change UK couldn't agree on a name. The SDP tore itself apart over the Liberal merger. UKIP, which isn't on our list because it actually succeeded in its core goal, still went through a revolving door of leaders and constant factional warfare. It turns out that people who leave established parties because they can't work with others often can't work with others.
Shocking.
I know. Who could have predicted?
But let's talk about the knock-on effect, because this is where it gets interesting. These failures often change the parent party more than they change politics. The SDP's pressure pushed Labour to the centre. The Dixiecrats accelerated the Southern realignment. The referendum party helped force the Conservatives to promise an EU referendum. The failure isn't always zero impact. It's just that the impact is never what the founders intended.
It's almost like these parties function as external R&D departments for the major parties. They test ideas, they mobilize a niche, they prove there's demand for something, and then the big party swoops in and harvests the demand without paying the cost of being the insurgent.
The major parties are like large tech companies acquiring startups. Why build it yourself when you can let someone else prove the market and then absorb it?
And that's the tragedy for the founders. They do the hard work of identifying a real political gap. They take the risk, they endure the ridicule, and then the established party says, "Thank you very much, we'll take it from here." Goldsmith wanted to be the man who delivered a referendum. Instead, David Cameron called the referendum and Goldsmith's party was a footnote.
So what do these parties consistently misread? I think it's three things. First, they misread intensity. The people who agree with them agree strongly, but there aren't enough of them. Second, they misread the polling. A protest answer in a survey isn't a vote. Third, and this is the big one, they misread what voters actually want from politics.
Say more about that third one.
Voters want outcomes. They want the economy to grow, they want healthcare to work, they want to feel safe. They don't want a new party. A new party is a means to an end, not the end itself. These founders consistently mistake their own fascination with political realignment for the public's. Most people don't think about party structures. They think about whether their life is getting better. If a new party doesn't immediately and obviously connect to that, it's just noise.
The SDP's pitch was essentially, we're more competent and moderate than Labour, and we're more compassionate than the Tories. Which might have been true. But voters don't vote on organizational competence in the abstract. They vote on whether they think you'll make their life better in ways they can feel. And the SDP never made that case clearly enough.
Change UK's pitch was even worse. It was basically, we aren't the other guys. That's not a platform. That's a mood.
The Natural Law Party's pitch was, we'll meditate and crime will go down, which is at least specific, even if it's completely detached from reality.
I want to circle back to something. The monster-raving loony party is still around. They've been running candidates for 40 years. They've never won a seat. They've never come close, but they've survived. And I think the reason is that they're the only party on this list that actually understood what they were. They never claimed to be a serious political force. They were a joke. They knew they were a joke, and the public appreciated the honesty.
There's something almost profound about that. The loony party succeeded at being what it set out to be. The SDP, Change UK, Veritas, the referendum party, they all failed at being what they set out to be. The loony party's ambition was to be a beloved joke, and they achieved it. That's more than most of these parties can say.
The sincerity gap. The more sincerely a party believes it's about to transform politics, the funnier the failure. The loony party was never sincere, so its failure was never humiliating. It was just the punchline.
Now, before we write all these parties off as pure comedy, Hilbert has a case to make that we're being too harsh.
I want to push back on the framing here. You've both been talking about these parties as if they failed because they were stupid or vain or couldn't read the room, but I think that lets the system off the hook too easily. Take the SDP. They got 25% of the vote and 23 seats. Labour got 28% and 209 seats. That's not a failure of political judgment. That's a failure of the electoral system. The public did want a centrist alternative. The polls weren't a mirage. The demand was real. But first past the post makes it structurally impossible for a new party to convert votes into seats unless its support is geographically concentrated. The SDP's support was spread evenly across the country, which is the worst possible distribution under that system.
That's fair. The electoral system was a huge factor. Under proportional representation, the SDP would have had a real presence in Parliament and might have survived.
And Change UK. You said they were a mess of egos with no platform, and they were. But they also launched in 2019, when the political conversation was completely dominated by Brexit. There was no oxygen for anything else. The Brexit Party sucked up all the anti-establishment energy on the right. The Liberal Democrats were already occupying the centrist anti-Brexit space. Change UK was trying to squeeze into a gap that was already occupied. That's not just incompetence. That's timing.
Timing and luck are real. But Change UK's internal chaos wasn't caused by the electoral system or the timing. They couldn't agree on a name. They had no policy platform beyond vibes. Even if the system had been friendlier, they were a mess.
I'm not saying they were competent. I'm saying the deck was stacked. And the referendum party, you called it a vanity project. But 2.6% of the vote in 1997 for a single-issue party that had only existed for 3 years in a system designed to crush single-issue parties, that's not nothing. And you both acknowledged that their pressure helped force the referendum. So, was it really a failure? Or was it a successful pressure campaign that happened to take the form of a political party?
That's a fair point. If Goldsmith's goal was to force a referendum, he succeeded. He just didn't live to see it, and his party wasn't the vehicle.
My point is that we call these parties failures because they didn't win seats. But winning seats isn't the only way to have impact. The Dixiecrats didn't win the presidency. They didn't even come close. But they reshaped American politics for decades. The SDP transformed the Labour Party. The Reform Party put Ross Perot's issues on the national agenda, and those issues, trade, deficits, political reform, didn't go away. Maybe the real lesson is that political success is often about timing and luck, not just competence. These parties weren't just stupid. Some of them were unlucky.
I'll concede the electoral system point. First past the post is a graveyard for third parties, but I won't concede the natural law party. Yogic flying isn't a structural problem. That's just a bad idea.
No argument there.
I think where we land is that political failure is a mix of bad luck, bad decisions, and bad ideas, and the proportions vary. The SDP was mostly bad luck and a hostile system. Change UK was mostly bad decisions. The Natural Law Party was mostly bad ideas, and we'll never know exactly which mattered most in any given case.
Which is maybe the most honest thing we can say. The next time you hear about a game-changing new party, remember the SDP's 40% polling, and ask yourself who's actually going to show up to vote. The gap between the press release and the ballot count is where these parties go to die.
If the party's core policy involves bouncing in the lotus position, maybe sit that one out.
This has been My Weird Prompts with our producer Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this tour of political wreckage, tell someone about the show or find us at myweirdprompts.com. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.